accession number 26561, reel 16.
Wing Commander Bernard, reel 16. Now, we're talking about when you were in the NCO centre camp at Stalag Luft 3.
Yeah.
And I think the next thing that we're going to move on to, although you're not sure of the date, is when most of the NCOs were moved out, which is... Now, can we take up the story from there, what do you remember of that?
Yes, all the NCOs, apart from a few, were sent up to Heidekrug to open up the new Luftwaffe camp there. Dixie Deans, the leader, asked me if I would stay behind because the camp was going to be filled up with American airmen, and he didn't think they would have radio expertise, and my old radio in the war was still intact there. So I agreed to this at his behest. And they all moved out, and very shortly after they'd gone, a flood of American Air Force came in. Colonel Spivey was their leader, and I got him, he was delighted to have me on his entourage. I was allegedly there for looking after, as a warrant officer, looking after a small handful of batmen who were other NCOs who would look after the Americans on the various internal camp services.
And did you actually do that?
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
Tell us a bit about what you were meant to be doing then. I mean, I know that's you were there for other reasons, but what was that like, the role looking after the batmen or the officer's servants, you know?
Oh, yes. Seeing those rosters of people to heat up the water and the cookhouse and various routine things such as those. It also gave me a contact with the Germans in charge of the cookhouse, which I was able to not con them exactly, but to get some sort of rapport with them for future components, if possible. The Americans were fine. They thoroughly appreciated me getting news on the clandestine radio.
Did they have their own radio wireless specialists or not?
I never came across them because one morning on the parade, I was called out and put to one side, and together with those from the East Camp. Remember, the American camp was the center camp, had now become officers of the American Air Force. Just officers, not NCOs. And the NCOs went up to Heidekrug with the British NCOs. But I was called out on parade, and I wasn't told why. I was amazed, and other officers from East Camp and so on, Stamford Tuck, for example, and Dim Strong, Air Commodore Dim Strong, and all sorts of people were pulled off the Appel parade and put into a lorry, and we were sent to the Naughty Boys camp at Valeria.
Now, was this ever explained to you?
Not really, no. It's only as I was there, as they had all sorts, had Beaumont and all sorts of aces put there. And I can only assume, but they wanted me again to look after Batman, to be the chief man looking after Batman.
So you weren't being sent as a naughty boy, you were being sent as a warrant?
I wondered about this. I don't know whether the Germans ever suspected me for anything because of my passing the exams up at Bath in radio. That may have given them a clue.
Now, before we leave there's two things. The first is a bit more about how you got on with the American officers.
Oh, splendidly, yes. I complained, or rather, the for example, Colonel Spivey said to me he wanted to. I negotiated with the Germans, and they had a very small room in the cookhouse there, which was full of salt, sack after sack after sack of salt. And I said, well, they said, well, you could have the salt room if you can find an alternative for all the storage of sacks. I was negotiating on Colonel Spivey's behalf, and he agreed it. And I said to Spivey, I said, my chaps are busy stoking boilers in the cookhouse and doing all sorts of thing. I can't take them off that job to unload sacks of salt. He said, no problem at all. He said, my officers can do that. And he had a whole host of officers come in and put the sacks on my back and waltz it to I don't know where.
So you got on well with him?
Oh, very well, yes.
What was Colonel Spivey like?
Oh, an excellent character. Robust and forthright. I had to warn him how to handle the Germans on a few occasions.
What was he doing wrong?
Well, he was just sort of shouting them down and that sort of thing. And I said, you do better to appear friendly.
And the other thing is the question of the Great Escape, which I know you weren't personally involved.
No, that was in another camp. That, we're talking about Centre Camp. That was in North Camp.
Now, so did you know anything about it at all?
Not a thing, no. Not until post-war.
So, in that way, the sense at least the security...
Oh, no, sorry, no, it was earlier than post-war, no. We did hear about it when the 50 were shot, yes.
But you knew nothing of the planning or the tunnels
no,
or where it was
no,
going from or
no,
anything
no.
before it happened?
That's
at any
right.
Rate.
It's now well known that Tom, Dick and Harry tunnels were in being...
And did they use any of your stuff? I mean, or could
I had no way of finding that out.
Now, what about the move to Bellaria?
Yes, they put us, bundled us in. We weren't even permitted to go back to the huts to collect our belongings. And I think this went for East Camp. Naughty boys as well, and they just packed us in this lorry, and we were the start of overloading into Camp Bellaria, Stalaglof 4, not generally known. It was more of an affiliated to 3. I think they shared the organisation.
So it was at Bellaria's nearby, then?
It was, about 10 miles away, yes.
And you don't know when you went there?
I can't remember the actual...
Even approximately? Winter, summer?
I think I've worked it out somewhere in that list.
Yeah, we just looked it up. You reckon it's June 43?
Suspect it. purge to Bellaria, Stalaglof 4... I was aware.
So we go, yeah, right, because that's a year before the Great Escape. I've got that missed wrong. So I didn't realise you'd gone that earlier to Bellaria. Now, so what were your first impressions on arriving at Bellaria?
Oh, well, without any personal belongings at all. And we had Group Captain MacDonald, who was the senior officer. He was very friendly. I knew Stanford Tuck, who was a Battle of Britain ace. And Beaumont, Billy Beaumont, are both very bemedaled heroes. It was quite a small camp, really. There were only 4 huts in it at the time. They added others a bit later on. It seemed all right. It was supposed to be more foolproof, more secure from the Germans' point of view as a camp.
In what way? What was more secure about it?
I believe they had the anti-tunneling trench round the outside was in being, as it was in Bath, but it wasn't in being at Sagan. And the usual, surrounded by woods, which was to our advantage. But the soil was different. It was there weren't as many tree roots around to hold the earth together. It was very sandy from our tests.
Now, were you as an NCO or warrant officer separated yes. from the officers? Or?
Oh no. Well, I well, in so much as we had a room in the officers' in a hut of the officers' compound. It was only officers there in Bulgaria.
So it was just you and how many other warrant officers?
Another one joined us, Alan Morris, the great escaper from Luft 3, joined us there. He was probably considered a naughty boy from the escaping point of view. They put him there, and he and I were together, and we had the odd airman, LAC, or junior tech, not junior, there weren't any junior techs then. Yes, LACs mostly. Early AC2s and LACs.
And they were the officer's servants or batmen?
That's right, yes. Well, they didn't actually serve under the batting regime. They were really services of the compound, like looking after the cookhouse and washing the spuds before they boiled them in their jackets and that sort of thing.
Now, well, what was Morris like? Let's talk about. He was a warrant officer, was he, at the time?
Alan Morris. Oh, yes, yes, we're both warrant officers.
And he was a warrant officer.
That's yeah. right, yes.
What was he like?
Oh, fantastic guy. He was the one that was part educated at Heidelberg and spoke Hochdeutsch. And he really was a born leader of men, in so much as when we evacuated Bulgaria for the long march, he stood up and marshalled all the officers who were running around like headless hens.
We'll come to that. What was he like as a bloke to you?
Oh, fine, yes. He's very good, very clever, very astute. In latter life, he became managing director of Wiggins Teep Africa.
Now,
paper people, yes.
How did you settle into the camp routine then? Was life much the same as at Stellenbosch?
Oh, much the same as centre camp, yes. And I started to build my radio. Of course, I had no spare parts then. I had no ways. The cookhouse German was uncorruptible, and so I wasn't getting anywhere there. But I set out to manufacture my own components, and I built one radio that I'd brought some. I don't know how they arrived. Probably Alan Morris got them for me, because he could converse with the Germans. But I was then the group captain, MacDonald, who was the senior officer, who lived in the hut which we called the flagship, because he had his own little room at the end there. And, yes, Alan Morris was very helpful in those. And then they decided that they needed a commissioned signals officer. And I built them a set. And he took it over. He didn't know a volt from an ohm. And he was a beautiful key basher. But that was his forte. And he wasn't very switched on hiding things. And I built this radio again in the vertical slats of the wall of the huts. And again, with the usual photo frame twisted, and it undoes the panel. And he used to operate this set, and he was very ham-handed with it, and was always calling me in to readjust it for him. And then we had collected these parts through Alan Morris, bargaining with the Germans. And I said to him, well, we have enough to do this set. Will you, we better put them in a large container and seal it and bury it in the allotment gardens where they were growing the odd vegetables.
You mean for later, when it might be needed?
Yes, but it was a way of stowing radio parts that weren't used at that time. And he said, no, you wouldn't have it buried, you'd never find them. I said, well, you can pace out on coordinates and log those somewhere, and you'll know exactly where you've buried them, and they'll be sealed in a large tin can, most useful. But he wouldn't agree to this, and he lost. And then he left a loop of wire hanging out in between the grooving of the of this vertical slat of wood. And the Germans found this. And he then was given a radio that had built by the post office in Dollis Hill, which was in fact moulded into a block of chocolate in a Red Cross parcel. It was a wonderful little thing. It had what were known as acorn valves, tiny little valves. It was an 8-ounce bar of chocolate coating on this set. It had little drawers in it with my minute mains connections and minute earphone, and it was really a wonderful piece of equipment, which I checked out and tuned up. It was fine. And then he took it over, and he was so stupid that he put it in the base of a homemade armchair out of Canadian Red Cross boxes. At the base of that were full of magazines, and he put it in there, and the Germans found it. And what with him losing the two radios that I'd built, I was a bit hacked off with this. And Group Captain MacDonald sent for me and said, Bernard, what about building another set? And I said, can I think about it and come back to you on this? Because I have no parts now. This foolish flight lieutenant had left all these spares in the base of this vertical compartment, and we lost the lot. So I was very, very distraught about this. And so I said, well, you know, we haven't got any parts, and the Germans had clamped down on being corruptible. So the only other thing I could do was to make most of the components myself. And so I made all the various components. The telephone was the... Well, I couldn't make thermionic valves, that was for sure. I needed a mercury pump to do that, and I was fresh out of mercury at the time. The earphone was a pillbox which is cut down with a wooden base and diagonal slots to hold the wooden base by a crease. Because they were slanting, one could adjust the magnet assembly to the diaphragm of the thing by twisting it. And the magnet came out of the handle of an Eclipse razor. An Eclipse razor. The handle contained a magnet which the Germans hadn't discovered. It was commercially used for picking up the razor blades. It was a dodge that sold the razor. But to me, it was very precious. It took me a week to get it out of the handle. I couldn't heat it up when I lost the magnetism, and so I had to gently file it with the magnet lined up north and south to keep its polarity. That was a little one-inch piece of magnet, little slug of magnet, and I made a cause to wrap around the ends and wound them up and used the diaphragm for the from a tobacco tin seal. And to tune it up, I got a couple of safety pins and made spears out of them and punctured the propaganda loudspeaker circuits and tuned it up on those. So I had a working earphone by then.
It worked.
Arnold Morris blackmailed a German whom we nicknamed Bean Kopf because he had the head the shape of a bean. And he eventually brought in two nondescript thermionic valves. One I recognised by the number of contacts, which were not pin contacts, they were side contacts, and there were a ring of contacts round the base pointing outwards. I adjudged that, and I couldn't see inside the valve because the outside was covered in silver conductor for shielding purposes, and the inside was gettered with the silver from the magnesium, from the mercury. But I was able to trace out with Ray and I made a homemade voltmeter and found the 6 volts on that, and I could test through that it was the heating element, so I knew I needed 6.3 volts for that. And I tied all the, and I found the earthy one because that was contacted to the outer silver covering. So I found earth and I found the heaters and found there. So I put all the others, grouped them, soldered them all together, externally of course, and that gave me a diode for rectifying the mains into 110 volts for the high tension element of the valve system.
Now we've talked about some of the things we made already, the resistors, the tuning capacitors, things like that. We've already discussed.
Yes, I repeated those, of course.
That was just done again.
Yes.
Anything else that stands out about this wireless you made?
No, I'm still having problems with the, although I've got the hang of it now, the smoothing capacitor that went with the choke, which was a bundle of razor blades again. And that was my supply for the high tension set up for the thermionic valves. It worked well, and Alan Morris was very good at shorthand and would take down all the BBC news again.
Now, where did you conceal it?
I had two. When the group captain sent for me and said, you know, get another one, I went back to him and said, I see the best way of doing this is to locate the NCOs and myself in a room next to the library, and we'll hide the radio in two large volumes and put them on the top shelf. And that's what we did. He agreed to that, and he said, well, you can build it in my room. He had his own private room at the end of a hut, and he invited me. He said, if anyone comes in and surprises us whilst you're building it, I'll just throw a blanket over it, because they'd knock on his door, throw a blanket over it, and we were discussing Batman problems.
And which books did you choose?
Two volumes of the History of New Zealand, 1 and 2. And all the centre pages were cut out, and a plywood box created to contain all these. And they were coupled together by plug and sockets that were made out of toothbrush handles and scrolls of thin tin.
And so the two parts together, you had a power pack and
And a one valve radio.
Now, just to think, because people, this is a receiver, not a transmitter.
Oh, yes. You couldn't get the power for a transmitter. It needed special valves and an enormous amount of power for the transmissions, which I certainly didn't have the capability of producing.
So nobody ever managed to build one of them?
No one, no.
Now, so... And this was a successful place of concealment?
Very successful. And, in fact, I had a little shelf with all my books, private books, on it. And if I was operating it, I would put those books, set it all up, get it working, and push them into the bookcase, hide the wiring under my mattress, and the earphone was put into my straw felt pillow. And I could be writing home a letter if anyone came into the building. The other thing I did...
The signal officer wasn't allowed anywhere near this one.
I said to him, I don't want any interference. I just agree to supply the news under my own auspices.
Now, who took... So you operated the wireless?
Yes.
And who took down the news?
Alan Morris, because he knew shorthand.
And that was for the rest of the time in that camp?
In that camp, yes. And indeed, when we were evacuated from that, I took the two-book radio with me on the sledge.
Now, anything... I mean, you were at that camp longer than I thought. I hadn't realised you'd gone there in June 43. So you were there in a year and a half.
That's right, yes.
Anything happened? What about escape activity generally there?
No, we couldn't do it. It wasn't feasible. Don't ask me why. I say my contribution was providing radios. That was my main theme.
Now, how were you reacting to the news? Because by 43 into 44, you know, things are starting to happen, aren't they?
Yes.
I mean, how did you react to the news? First of, well, the Russians started to push forward early on.
Yes, it was interesting. We had a map in one of the huts. I think it was in the corridor of one of the huts. A map with where the front line was, and the Germans didn't obviate this, they didn't go around. And it was interesting to note that we got more information from the German news, which was propaganda-wise, was what came over the loudspeakers in the camp. And theirs was more up-to-date. Their advancement was up-to-date, and they had to keep it going quickly because the Russians were going so fast. At that time we had communications through the BBC News, and if the code for one particular was, if the BBC Evening News, 9 o'clock news came through and started with General Eisenhower states, that was a code for stay put in the camps, we'll come and get you. But of course Hitler had different ideas.
And that is later. So you found the German propaganda broadcasts were more up to date
than the BBC
and
News.
And they were reasonably honest. Did they match up?
They had to, because the Russians were advancing so fast that if they announced the retreat in little bits, it wasn't as bad as a week's gap where they've advised a tremendous distance.